Can you all hear me? Loud and clear? Excellent. Is this homemade? I had a feeling. That's it. Whoever had that thought, and whoever contributed, and whoever rejoices now in this, they all earn merits. Well done. Sometimes it's not the big things, the little things. Small steps can take you a long way. It's just being thoughtful. These are creative ways in which you can earn merits, isn't it? Just by ushering someone in, offering someone a seat, making sure someone has a drink of water if they're thirsty, all these things. When you use the washrooms, if you can make sure before you leave that it is in a usable state so that the next person who comes in will find it a pleasant place to do what they have to do. All of these things are meritorious deeds. Whenever you spare a thought on someone else's behalf, all of that is merits, ladies and gentlemen. They don't have to be big, grand things. Little things. Let's bring our palms together then, in veneration of the Lord Buddha, the perfect one, our master, our teacher, and our guide, reminding ourselves that it is in the footsteps, in his footsteps that we follow, to fulfill and practice the Noble Eightfold Path to the ultimate destination that is destined and deserved by all of us. Let us also remind ourselves that this is an opportunity that we take to renew our pledge of allegiance to Nibbana, that is the Buddha, to the doctrine, to get us there, that is the Dhamma, and to our practice, that is the Sangha. May the Noble Triple Gem forever be our guide and our refuge. Let us also take this opportunity to renew our precepts and make a solemn promise to ourselves that we remain virtuous and we remain the good and kind-hearted people that we always have been to all around the world, and to be the gift that we can be to all people's lives. Let us now take this moment to do that. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So, the first timers are particularly probably wondering what this last precept is. Sabba sattesu metta sahagatena chetasa viharana samadhiyami. We've talked about this the first day I introduced it and also subsequently. But in a nutshell, if none of the other precepts make a lot of sense to you, let's say either because it is not your faith, maybe Buddhism is not your faith, and that's perfectly fine, because this is not for people of Buddhist religion. These talks are for people who are, truth seekers. They're looking for the truth in life. It's not for anyone in particular who is religious. So you can be atheistic, you can be Buddhist, you can be theistic, it doesn't matter. These are for people who are inquisitive, people who are open-minded, people who are prepared to look at life from another lens because they have some kind of problem in their lives. I think that would be true for everyone, which is why you're here. There must be something that's bugging you. That's why you're here. Either because you're unhappy about something, maybe you get annoyed once in a while and you're not happy about that. Maybe you're frustrated, maybe you're disappointed about something. Maybe some things, you know, you're just not going through a a great time in life right now, something's going wrong, or you just, you know, you're looking for something that is still seems like it's out there but you haven't achieved it yet, somehow you're not fulfilled, and that's what you're looking for. And the purpose of these talks is to help you figure that out. So it has nothing to do with religion, which by extension means that there may be some among you for whom the precepts will be a bit foreign or maybe alien even. And that's perfectly fine. But this last precept, sabba sattesu metta sahagatena chetasa viharanam samadhiyami, encapsulates the essence of all of the other ones. So even if you can't make a lot of sense of the other five precepts, if you can simply make sense of this last precept, and that is to be compassionate towards all sentient beings, that is the precept that you take on. A precept is something that you take on to practice. Yes, that's what a precept is. It's a pledge you take on yourself, and you commit yourself to a practice, the practice of being compassionate to all sentient beings. One might ask, why should I be like that? Why should I be compassionate to all sentient beings? I think the simple answer is, how would you like to be treated by others? Wouldn't you like others to be compassionate towards you? Well then, everyone else is the same, isn't it? Treat others how you'd like to be treated. And that's the simple reason why it makes sense to treat others compassionately. Then of course there is the other angle of this. What you give is what you get. So if you love to be, like to be, love to be whatever, treated with compassion and kindness and have soft-spoken words directed at you, and you want people around you to be gracious towards you, then one of the best things you could do is actually be the same to the people around you. The truth is, ladies and gentlemen, we always create the world around us in the way that we think, the way that we speak, and the way that we act. The latter two are an extension of the first. The way you think extends into the way you speak and to the way you act. So really, the most important thing in your life is actually how you think about just about anything. We've talked about accidents and incidents in the past. In your life, there will be plenty of incidents which will seem like they're accidents, but they're only accidents when you're not prepared to accept them equanimously. When you have an agenda of your own, when you'd rather wish that something happened else, somewhere else, or something some other way, that's when you feel like it's an accident. But in life, really, all that's going on are incidents. But we're not prepared to accept them in that way, and that's what creates conflict in our minds. So these talks are to help you to be at peace. And you might wonder, with whom? What do you think? To be at peace with whom? Your husband? Your wife? Huh? That's a tall order, isn't it? Your colleagues or your boss at work? To be at peace with whom? With oneself, absolutely. Absolutely. It is to help you to be at peace with oneself. The reason that you find yourselves not at peace, conflict, is because there's an agenda that's on the inside. And that is at odds with what's going on out there. Which also means that when you're happy, this conventional sense of happiness is when your agenda aligns with what's going on out there. Either way, you have an agenda. What do you think about that? See, the thing is this. God has an agenda for you, and then you have your own agenda. For the God believers among you, God has an agenda for you, and then you have your own agenda. He always wins. For those who are non-God believers, well, karmic energy or vipaka energy, That is the agenda. Then you have your own agenda. So when these two things collide, one of two things will happen. Either they will align perfectly, and then you are at peace, not really, but in that moment it feels like, yay, life is good. This is that roller coaster of life where you feel like you are at a peak. Things are going well. Then you have a smile on your face. But then there are the other times when, on this roller coaster, you have the troughs. What happens then? Your agenda does not align with God's agenda or with the agenda that has been set in place by your karmic energy, whichever way you want to look at it. See, I can tell you the same story from two different angles. If you want me to give you a talk that you might hear at the church, I can do that as well. If you want to hear a talk that you would hear at the temple, I can give you that as well. Because either way, it's all the truth. Just two stories related by two different schools of thought who were both looking at the same truth. It's like if two people were looking at this. Some of you from this side of the room, others from the other side of the room. You're both speaking the same truth. Yeah? But if you turn this around, you realize, they're both saying the same thing. So, for someone who has made the effort to look at it from both sides, they can talk to you in whichever way makes sense to you. So you will know from our talks in the past, I've often talked about how one could look at the world from a theistic point of view. If you think that there's God up there and He has a plan for you, and how you can be friends with God, so you can form a pact with God and make sure that He keeps you happy. There's a way to do that. There is a way to do that. That is to make sure that you follow His instructions. He put you in this world to look after His creations, to be good and to be kind and to be gentle to others. If you do that, then He's going to be happy. And when He's happy, He'll keep you happy. The same story I can tell you in terms of karma and vipaka. If you are good to others, then you generate good karmic energy. And that karmic energy is up somewhere. And when it comes to fruition, you enjoy the rewards of that. Whereas if you are evil, vicious, vile, and you hurt other people, once again you're generating karmic energy. And that karmic energy will come to bite you on the back. So either way, you call the shots. See, God is very fair. He's very fair. He will only treat you as you deserve to be treated. And so is karmic energy. It's very fair. What I don't like is when people look up to God and they ask Him, "When I've been so good, why do you treat me like this? When I've never hurt anyone, when I've always been a good, loyal subject, why do you treat me like this?" That's an unfair request to God, because you don't remember the things you've done in the past. See, when someone asks, "How come I'm a good person? I've always only done good things. How come bad things happen to me?" And you choose to ignore the fact that there was a previous life, a life before this. Well, that's your own choosing. Why do you want to try and find answers that way? Why is it that the deeds of your past you can simply choose to neglect or ignore, and then think that, you know, every time you are born you start off with a blank canvas? It can't be like that. It's never like that. So you see, when you die, according to some religions, when you die, there's judgment, right? So you either go to hell or to heaven. So either way, you know, when you're dead, your actions are judged meaning things you've done in your past are judged, and as a result of that, your future is determined. So if you've done good to others, then you get to enjoy the rewards of that. If you've done bad to others, then you have to suffer the consequences. Once again, there's a cutoff, right? That's your death. And then things are determined based on that. Now, with karmic energy, you don't necessarily have to die for that. Whatever you're doing now itself is all karmic energy, and that karmic energy can come to you at whatever point. All that needs to happen is the environment needs to be ready. Once the environment lines up, those vipakas come to fruition. When we understand this simple principle, we feel empowered. And that's what I want you. That's what I want to do for you. I don't want you to feel victims of circumstances. I don't want you to feel like someone's calling the shots, someone gets to decide whether I'm going through a good time or a rough time. It shouldn't be like that, ladies and gentlemen, and it never is, and it never was, and it never will be. No one gets to decide whether you're going to live a good life or a bad life. No one besides you. The only destiny that awaits you is the one that you decide. That is your destiny. If you want to live a good life, then you can do. All you have to do is decide to do so and take action. If you can't be bothered, or if you don't really care whether you're going to have a good life or not, then certain things will still happen around you, and then we'll just have to keep quiet and accept whatever happens. But we don't need to be like that. We are human beings, we have the power of thought, we are intellectual, right? And we can choose what happens to us simply by choosing what we do in this moment. It's every moment that is presented to us. Whatever decision you make right now will have an effect on your future. I mean, these are simple truths. This is not rocket science. I know everyone understands this basic stuff, but sometimes we tend to forget, or sometimes even tend to ignore, and tend to point our finger outwards and say, he's responsible, she's responsible, he's the one, she's the one who makes me unhappy. And that's why you always have these problems at home, at the workplace. Whenever you're angry, who do you think makes you angry? Who's responsible for your anger? Someone else, right? That's what you always tell yourself. Because you always keep pointing your finger to someone else, there's never going to be a day where you're going to be free of anger. See, there's a fire here, and you're trying to put it out there. When is the day that fire is going to be extinguished? You tell me? Never, right? Exactly. So the first thing we have to do is first accept responsibility for what we are going through. I think that's where all of this has to start. We have to take responsibility for what we are going through. The good things, the bad things, pretty much everything. That's why when someone comes and asks me, Swami Nohansa, I know someone, she's going through a tough time these days. She's the victim of domestic abuse, right? Her husband's beating her up, right? And things are really going difficult for her. What do you think? How can we serve justice? Then they don't like some of the things I say after that. Because sometimes people tend to bring me these problems expecting me to somehow vindicate the person who's going through this experience and point fingers at the person who the perpetrator is. But what's the point of me doing that? By fixing someone else, how can you ever be redeemed? So if you ever ask me, Swami Nohansa, I'm going through a really tough time these days, I'm really going through a rough patch, where should I start? All I can say is, start with yourself. Start with yourself. It's not to do with others. Whatever you're going through, you deserve. Sorry. You know, if you throw a rock up in the sky, it's going to fall on your head. Whose fault is that? So stop throwing rocks and start throwing flowers then. Then they'll fall on your head. If you'd like to be showered by flowers, then throw flowers up in the sky. If you expect to throw rocks up in the sky, but then expect a shower of flowers, I mean, that's lunacy. Only what you have thrown up falls on your own head. Please remember that, and remember that well and forever. So then why am I here? Why are we having this conversation? Well, to one, teach you about this, and if you already know about this, to remind you about this, and then to convince you that you get to decide the remainder of how your life is going to work out. It may have happened a certain way up until this point, but it doesn't have to be from here on if you don't like it. You can change it. If until this point you have suffered in your life, for whatever reason, that you have felt that you have been a victim of various situations, circumstances, it doesn't have to be like that from here on, ladies and gentlemen. You call the shots. Take the reins into your own hands. You're king. You decide. Decide what you want for yourself. If you want to receive, there's only one way to receive. You have to give. There's no other way. To get, you must give. Whatever you get is whatever you have given. That's the only way. The only way. Don't look for an alternative. There are no easy alternatives or shortcuts. Life is not meant to be that way. God's not unfair, that's what I'm saying. If you've given, then you deserve to receive. Duh. Don't you think so? I mean, just think about it. There's a man who all he does is give, give, give and give. He always gives. Whatever he has, whatever little he has, he gives. Then there's one who's stingy. He doesn't give anything. He keeps on hoarding stuff. Why would God give to that man? Why would karma give to that man? You know, it's like, think about a lake. We have a tank at the monastery where we collect rainwater. Because we don't get rain throughout the year, but we get devotees throughout the year. And resident monks and anagarikas and anagarikas. I think just a couple of weeks ago we passed the 520 mark, permanent residents. And now apparently we get about 2,500 to 3,000 people every week who come in through our gates. And they all have to be fed and watered. And that's, you know, every time someone walks in through those gates, that's at least two flushes, isn't it? If they spend the day there. So, I mean, that's a large amount of water that we need. So, we always keep planning ahead for how things might turn out. Because, you know, people, they listen to the Dhamma and then they realize this is where we've been, we are going to find our solace. And you can't just say, I'm sorry, we have no water, don't come. Can't do that. That's what we have brains for. That's what our teachers have taught us things for. That's why we learn acquired skills. We know how to work with nature. And there's one other thing we always do. We keep on giving. Because we keep on giving, we always keep on getting. And we tell other people that that's how it works. There's no magic here. On an average day, we get about 800 people come into the monastery on a Saturday, at least on a Saturday. I mean, these are the busiest days that we have. Saturdays between 800 to 1,000, 1,200 people, easy. Every week. And they're all fed. Breakfast, lunch, and then after the sermon, before they go back home, you get a very famous roti. The world's best roti. Carefully crafted and made with lots of love and affection by our own anagarikas. These are the very young men who go on to become monks. Today they feed your stomach, tomorrow they feed your minds. Yes. Pretty much all of our anagarikas who you see come in, you know, they set up these things and they do all this. I call them the backbone of our monastery. Without them we wouldn't survive. These are your sons. Sons you have given to the sasana. I mean, they loved the sasana. As if it was their own mother and father. They look after and they protect and they provide. It's they who do most of the work, besides the Swaminarayan says. Because the Swaminarayans don't often come to your, you know, into your sight. So they're doing all their stuff out of public sight. But the Anagarika Matas, you know, we have no problem with that. Because sometimes you might not like to see a Swami Nohanse cooking for you. Simply because of out of devotion. I understand that. I understand that. But from time to time, when we have an opportunity, we always go to the kitchen. If I have an opportunity, I peel some onions or chop some onions or do some work in the kitchen. And because I like to earn my own merits as well. Because I know, you know, when you come to the monastery, it's a meal that you take for one purpose and one purpose alone, which is to attain Nibbana. So what am I prepared to do for your Nibbana? Only preach to you? If what I have to do is to wash the toilet that you have used, so be it. If that's what I have to do, I'm prepared to do that. If it's cooking a meal for you so that you're not hungry before you sit down for the sermon, oh my boy, am I glad to do that or not? I am. There's no problem. Because all of this is for Nibbana. So Anagarika Matas, what they do is, you know, when you're sat in the sermon on a Saturday, they're busy in the kitchen making the rotis and the gilampasa so that you can have something before you leave, so you don't have to go home hungry. And they cook your arms, your lunch. Swami Nohanse's help with that as well, whenever they have the opportunity. And then if you bring your children with you, then they look after your children while you are sat in the sermon. It's like full service. You get the whole works, right? Why? You must ask why. Why without a penny? Why do we do all this? Because we exist for the purpose of Nibbana. If you come forward and say, Swami Nohanse, Nibbana is what I want, then to that end, ladies and gentlemen, we are prepared to go to the world's end. Of course, what is cooked is what you have offered. So, because we don't make a living. So the rotis that we make is from the flour that you offer. It's the water that you offer. The rice we cook is from the rice that you offer. Yes, so you know, this is a combined effort. We work on this together. But each one trying to earn some merits out of it. So the whole purpose of all of this is so that you can find that solace. You are looking for an answer, a solution to a problem. Sabba sattesu metta sahagatena chetasa viharanang samadhyami is all that. Acting compassionately so that every living being, every sentient being who has the capacity to free themselves from suffering is given every opportunity to do that. Today, ladies and gentlemen, you have the capacity to do that. You can still listen, you can still hear me speak. Your ears are still working. You can hear what I'm saying. There's going to come a day where you won't be able to. And when that day comes, I can't help you in this way. Today you're still fit and strong enough to bring yourself here to the school. And that means I can help you in that way. So for as long as you are strong enough to fight, you're on the battlefield, we will keep on nurturing you. One, by giving you the weapons to fight with. And that weapon is the Dhamma. Because your enemies can only be slain by using the weapon of Dhamma. No other weapon will work. You've tried that. You've tried every other weapon. You've tried throwing money at it, didn't work. It doesn't go away. You tried working hard. It doesn't go away. Some of the richest people in the world are the most depressed. Throwing money at problems like that doesn't solve them. I mean, you can buy a big house, but how can you buy freedom of mind? How can you buy that? How can you buy peace of mind? How can you buy happiness? How can you buy a good night's sleep? You can buy a good mattress and a soft pillow. But how can you buy a guilt-free conscience? You can't buy that, can you? So you can buy a good mattress, you can buy a soft pillow, but you can't buy a good night's sleep. You can't buy them. It has to come from within. And for that, your conscience should be guilt-free. For that, You must be able to put your hand on heart and say, all thoughts that come into my mind are those that are compassionate towards others. I don't have anger, resentment, jealousy, greed, or any of such thoughts towards others. I'm a good human being. I love. I have affection towards others. But unconditionally. You've got to be able to think that, say that, and actually be that. The Dhamma is to help you achieve that. The long and short of all this is, I really want each and every one of you to consider the Dhamma as a raft that gets you to the other end. This is not something that is an academic pursuit, and I've mentioned this in the past as well. Because today I'm going to talk to you about a few concepts, which some of it might be a little bit deep, some of it may be a little bit heavy. There are first-timers today in the audience as well, so I'm always a little bit hesitant whether that might put people off a little bit, but I have to say every week we're going to keep getting first-timers, in which case we won't be able to make any progress. But not to fear, because I do try and simplify these concepts as much as I possibly can. And failing that, you can always go back and watch the previous talks. So this is building up on those previous talks. Every week is a build up on the previous week. In some weeks we don't actually talk much Dhamma, but don't you think that it's not a build up from the previous week? Because this has to be, it's like, you know, when you walk, you put your left foot forward and then you don't put your left foot forward again, do you? It has to be the right foot forward. So the way Nibbana works is you have to do a little bit of tilling the land and then sowing the seeds. They have to happen together. That's what a good farmer does. You can't just keep on sowing seeds, because they have to root. And for that, the soil has to be loose. So you have to keep tilling the land as well. And then you have to put fertilizer. You have to give it water. You can't just keep on sowing seeds. Nothing's going to happen. So the merit stuff that we talk about, the merit stuff that we try and practice, you know, you coming to the monastery for the cutting up income and all that, you know, all of these for the ordination ceremony and supporting there and doing what you can there. All of these things are things that you do in the name of merits. That's tilling the land, so to speak. It's tilling the land. When you come here, you look after each other. That's tilling the land, ladies and gentlemen. If you have a spare seat in your car and you bring your neighbor here with you, or you bring a friend along, that's tilling the land. Don't ever let anyone convince you that those actions don't help you to attain Nibbana. They do. I can speak on myself. Today, I feel that for some reason, when my teacher gives me some instruction, when he teaches the doctrine, usually he has to make very little effort to help me understand it. And this is not me boasting. This is simply me saying this is an effect of causes. There's no one to boast here. It's simply cause and effect. I'm sharing this with you because then once you understand what the causes are that lead you to a certain effect, then you can do the same, can't you? So this is not proprietary. This is no one's. It's just the way it is. So I feel quite fortunate in that way, that when Guru Swaminathan gives a sermon, usually at the end of that sermon, I can relate everything that has been said by him and explain the sermon in the meaning that he intended it. I'm not saying all the time, but most of the time. So most often he would just like give me a short passage of something and says, think about it. And then maybe a day or two later, I can go and explain to him, isn't this what you meant? I said, yes, exactly, that's what I said. So he gives me a short snippet of something and I can analyze it for myself. That is an effect of causes, ladies and gentlemen. It's not my doing per se. And how did that happen? That happened because I helped people do that a lot. I still help people do that. Today, what am I doing here? What Guru Amaru has taught me, I try to teach you. So I help you make sense of it. So if that's what I give, yes, that's what I get. I remember when he was simply just a lay person 7-8 years ago, and he first started preaching as a lay person, my teacher. I had the good fortune to be there by his side, and every sermon he used to preach, we had a little voice recorder that was kept there, and we recorded it. And then I used to edit those talks. Initially, it was just the voice clips. I used to edit them and then put them online so that people somewhere, someone would listen to it and make use of it. So I did that because I wanted to do it, because I wanted to give people an opportunity to understand the Dhamma, because it was so beautiful. It had an effect on me. It had a very profound effect on me, and I wanted that effect for everyone. And then later on, few people started requesting whether they could join online while the sermon was in progress. So then we made an effort for that as well. So initially they were all on Skype. So we'd set up Skype and get a microphone plugged in, and then we actually had an online radio as well back many years ago. So at that specific time, predetermined time, the sermon would go online. And so there would be me sat on the side, the Deshaganwanse would be in the Dharmasana, I would sat on the side with the laptop on and plugging everything in. So everywhere we went, I had to set the whole thing up, like what Anagarika Mahathyas do today. So we'd record that and then make sure that people were able to listen to it comfortably. Sometimes some people would forget to mute their microphones, and because, you know, I've got to keep one ear on the sermon because I have to listen to the sermon myself, and the other ear on what people are saying on the Skype call. It wasn't easy. So sometimes I would hear, this ear would give it to me live and this ear would give it to me 2 seconds later. That wasn't easy. But I did it because it's what had to be done. Someone out there needed the Dhamma. That's why they would join online, and someone had to do it. And I did it wholeheartedly. Do you not see the causes that have led up to an effect? That's what I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen. If you want something, you've got to give it. Give it in whichever way you can. And that happened for many years before we decided to finally come into ropes. And then I remember people started to request this to be made available on YouTube. If you go back to the very old sermons, they had no video recording of like this, you know, you couldn't see the person giving the talk. They had like images, and we used to keep shifting through images because we didn't want to show our faces back then. Not that we now want to, but this is only due to popular demand, right? So people have said it's difficult to follow a sermon when you can't see the person giving the talk. And now we use these things, so it makes little sense to actually hide our faces behind the camera. So those days, the sermon, what I used to do was take the recording. So I'd already listened to this sermon. So they were not like half an hour sermons. Deshagatama has never done half an hour sermons. Those sermons were like 3 hours long, 4 hours long. You'd start on a Friday night. Friday night was it? No, Saturday night. No, Friday night. No, sorry, Saturday night it was. Saturday night. So the sermon usually started at about 7 o'clock at night. And it went on till about 3 in the morning. I'm not kidding. So what's that? 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3. Almost 8 hours. That's how long those sermons were. And so I'd record them, and then the following day, Sundays, so this was my weekend from after having spent 5 days at work. I had a very understanding wife, you can imagine. So then what would I do on a Sunday is I'd sit in front of the computer, load the file on, the recording, and then, because it had to go on YouTube now, I'd listen to the sermon, and for the various things that he would talk about, I had to go online and find suitable images. So if he talks about a tree, for example, I'd go online, find a tree, and then an image of that, and then put that on the audio. So I had a little computer at home, and on that I used to edit these videos, and I mean, some days it would take forever. This is an 8-hour long sermon. Sometimes at least they were 4 or 5 hours long. None of them were shorter than that. So that's how my weekends were spent. I mean, we hardly had time to go do any shopping. As I say, I had a very understanding other half. So some nights, you know, it was just throughout the night, I'd wake, stay up till the following morning. And I had a very understanding boss as well, who let me work from home whenever I wanted. Because on some days, I'd save the commute. I'd stay at home and do the editing so that when I had to start work, I was available. But the time I'd had to put into commuting, I was able to save to do these sermons up. So am I saying all this to you? So I want you to come and give me a pat on the back? No. I'm trying to teach you cause and effect. If for any reason you feel that some of these concepts that we talk about, either today or in the future or in the past, it's like flying over your head, or it's not making a whole lot of sense, you're grappling with them and really difficult to make sense of any of it, it's only because you need more merits, that's all. So don't be disheartened, because if you have a solution, there's nothing to worry about, right? You should only be disheartened when you don't know what to do about something. Now you do. You know, what you're doing here is exactly what you should be doing. Look at what you're doing here. You're creating an environment that is conducive for all to come along and practice the Dhamma. Listen to the sermons. You know, as people walk into the room, I see, you know, a few of you putting your hand up saying, hey, here, we've got a seat here, we've got a seat here. All of those things are merits. You mustn't undermine them. So if a newcomer comes in, you know, you make sure that they're comfortable. You ask them, how are you? Is everything okay? Do you know where the washrooms are? Right? All of that. That bit of hospitality just makes them feel more comfortable. They feel at home. And then when they sit down, they don't feel apprehensive. You know, they feel like this is a familiar, friendly place. So the mind is more receptive to the Dhamma. All of that matters, ladies and gentlemen. Each opportunity is an opportunity to earn some merits. That's why I said, Sabba Sattesu Metta Sahagatena Chetasa Viharanang Samadhyami. Sabba Sattesu is all sentient beings. Metta Sahagatena Chetasa Viharanang. Live with compassionate thoughts in your heart. Always. Always exist to do good to mankind. If someone asks you, why do you exist? So I can serve. So I can do good to others. That should be your purpose of existing. And the less you feel that you have to do something for yourself, the more you can do for others. That's the way it works. People can be as selfless as they want to be. The degree to which someone is selfless is the degree to which they are less selfish. In other words, the degree to which someone is selfless about others, or they are altruistic in their approach to others, is the degree to which they think less of themselves. When there's a huge self to be concerned and worried about, it's very difficult to think about what's good for others. Even in relationships, this is the reason that people often find themselves in hot water. If your relationship isn't going too well, if there's always problems, arguments, right? Just take a moment and ask yourself, is that not because most of the time you're thinking about what's good for you? If you can think more about what's good for the other person, and they can do the same, right? Usually in any relationship, one can do it better than the other. That's how it works. Unless you're both Rahatanvanses, in which case, why you're in a relationship? So if you're in a relationship, there's usually one who can think about the other more than the other person. And whoever that might be in your relationship, it may be you. In your relationship, it may be the other person. Whichever way, the more that one can think about the other person in any kind of relationship, and the less they can think about themselves, the stronger that relationship is. Because in that relationship, you exist to serve. This is also a relationship, the one that you and I have. This is a strong relationship. It's a very good, productive relationship. Because I come here to serve. So I'm going to now get into some concepts of Dhamma, and if not all of it makes sense, well, I have apologized to you in advance. But don't you worry, I will try and simplify it as much as I possibly can. From time to time I'm not going to give you opportunity to ask questions, because then it'll just, the conversation will get derailed. This is not the environment or the setup for that. But I'll ask you whether you've understood what I've said. In which case, just give me a nod. Either this way, or that way, or diagonally if it's kind of like neither here nor there. Right? And let's see. So I think we have about an hour or so, because today is the day that we give the gift of giving. Isn't it? Yes. So you want to give people an opportunity to offer some pindapatha, alms, to the monks and earn some merits out of that. You rejoice in that, don't you? It's wonderful. That's what it should be. So in the hour that we have, I'll try and relate to you something that I think is very interesting. But all of this is to the simple, this is all a means to an end, and that end is for you to be compassionate human beings. If you have understood all this Dhamma and still you're not a nice person to be around, then you haven't, you know, your coming here is in vain. As I always say, one of the best tests of whether Sunday mornings are productive is ask the people you live with. Ask them. Ask them whether you're a better husband. Ask them whether you're a better wife. Ask them whether you're a better child, a better mother, a better father to them. And if they say yes, they say, you know, you used to be very tough those days, but nowadays, you know, you softened. Now I can actually at least discuss something with you. Those days it wouldn't be like that. You know, it was always your way or the highway. But now we can talk about things, right? At least you are more considerate now. What happened? Then you can say Sunday morning happened. Right? That's the acid test. That is what this is all for. Nothing more. Because I don't give you a test, another test at the end of this. There's no exam paper. Yeah? We are not studying for a PhD. This is simply to become better human beings. That's all. Right. Now, to put it quite simply, the reason that you are still in samsara, are you still in samsara? Okay, good. I mean, not good, but the reason that you are still in samsara is because you want to be. You'll say, no, Swami, I don't want to be in samsara. That's what you say. But in your mind, you want to be. What you're saying does not agree with how you actually feel inside. So much so, if I said, well, if I can give you a sermon right now that will convince you that remaining at home is pointless, being, say, spending the rest of your life with at home, right, with the material possessions that you have at home with your family, friends and all that, is pointless. If I can give you a sermon that convinces you of that, are you prepared to come with me back to the monastery? Right? You're probably laughing right now. Only you're just being very polite so you don't laugh out loud. That's because, you know, you still want to be in samsara, because you still feel like there are things that are of value to you, things that are important to you. It could be material things. You still enjoy the pleasures of life. There are people that are important to you that you can't leave behind. There are things that are important to you that you can't leave behind. It's not necessarily a case of, if I come, how are they going to fend for themselves? It's not necessarily a case of that. It may be for a few of you, I admit. Perhaps there are a few of you who will say, Swaminand sir, if there was a way in which my son, my daughter, my husband or my wife, if my family could provide for themselves, and I know that they are steady, they are strong, I'm prepared to come any day. Right? If you, perhaps there are a few of you who say that, and that is the genuine truth. But perhaps even less than the number of fingers on my hand. The vast majority of you, it's fine, don't worry about it, right? We were all there once, okay? The vast majority of you, actually it's not simply a case of how can they survive without me? It's actually a case of how can I survive without them? That's still there. I want my wife to be with me. Because she makes me happy, I need her. Just her presence is enough, at least to know that she's there when I need her. That is important to me. To know that my husband's there for me when I need him. To know that my partner's there for me when I need him or her. I have my children with me, and you know, it's not just a case of who's going to provide for my children if I'm gone, but I need my children to be happy. There, that's what I'm talking about. When I see them running around, you know, laughing and enjoying themselves, you know, nothing makes me happier. It delights me as a father. It delights me as a mother. Just to see them happy. When they perform well, you know, and they get good grades, and you know, they pass their exams with flying colors, and people are talking and saying good things about them. When I go to school and the teachers are praising him or her for what they do, you know, it just, I'm elated. Those are the treasured moments of my life, will be some of the things that some of the parents here will say. That means you still want to be in samsara. Because if that whole package is samsara, you still want that. You're dependent on that. Because you're dependent on that, you can't be independent. So those are some of the people. Then there are the material things. For some of you, it might be your house. Might be your car, might be some other, maybe your phone. Don't be surprised. I mean, there are some young people who are so prepared to come if only they can bring their phones with them. But, you know, at the Anagarika program, you know, that is one of the rules that we have to lay down, because who knows what comes on the phones, right? I mean, it's safer to take someone who has HIV than actually to get them to bring their phone with them. Because in our phone, you have all sorts of trash, right? So, but there's a rule. You can't bring your phones with you when you come. You have to hand it over. But of course, for the first few months or so, when you need to make a call or, you know, whatever, you can collect your phone from your teacher, do what you have to do, and return your phone. You can't keep your phone on you. That's the policy that we have at the monastery. So there are some youngsters who are prepared to come if we allowed them to keep their phones on them, because they are dependent on the phone. It's like a drug. They're dependent on it. It's like if you had diabetes, you know, you're dependent on a drug. Was it insulin or something? And then you're dependent on it. So you need it for the rest of your life. In that way, people feel that they're dependent on some of these material possessions that they have. Now, of course, these material possessions, they can survive without the owner, but the owner can't survive without them. That's because you want them, you need them, and you treasure them. In other words, you are attached to them, and so you're not prepared to let go. You're not prepared to leave samsara, because samsara is what offers you these little things, these little gadgets. So if samsara is where you get all these things, you have to be in samsara to experience them and to enjoy them. Then for others, it could be experiences that you tend to have. Maybe you like going out from time to time. Maybe you like singing, dancing, music, clubbing, right? Perhaps. Maybe you like going out, you know, outing with your friends. Maybe you like adventures, that sort of thing. Maybe you like to go on a tour from time to time. Maybe you like to go on safaris. Maybe you like collecting stamps. Maybe you have some other hobbies like playing the guitar, or maybe whatever. Right? All of these things are things that samsara offers you. And because samsara offers them to you and you are dependent on them for your happiness, you can't exit samsara because you are bound to them. So, there are two reasons then, mainly, why people are not prepared to exit samsara. One is because you feel a sense of duty and responsibility and maybe even an obligation that there are others who are dependent on you and so I cannot go. The other reason is you are dependent on them and so you cannot go. The second one is the worst one, because you are dependent on something. When you are dependent on something, you'll have to keep coming back for it. So if you have it today and you lose it tomorrow, you'll have to find another one to substitute. That's the way it works. If you lose something you're attached to today, ladies and gentlemen, you can't live with it. You can't live from tomorrow onwards. If you lose it, you'll have to find something to replace it with. That's the way it works. This is all because you have given it value. Now here's where we're going to enter our conversation. You've given things value. I want to ask a question from you. These are rhetorical questions, so I want you to think in your mind. I'm not necessarily asking you to shout the answer out, but I want you to think, okay? This word value. What does value mean to you? Value. Put it up on the board. Value can mean lots of different things to people. Just have a think about what it means to you. What does the word value mean to you? I'm happy to offer a definition of the word value for the purpose of our discussion. I would like to propose that value is the ability of something, whatever that thing might be, to fulfill the ability of something to fulfill a necessity. The ability to fulfill a necessity. Now let me explain. You have a need for, let's say you're thirsty. You're thirsty. Now you have a need to quench your thirst. You don't necessarily need water. You have a need to quench your thirst. That's the need. I offer you a glass of water and this. Or a rock. I offer you a glass of water and a rock. Which one has more value? You're thirsty. Which one has more value? Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, it's a rock of diamond. It's a diamond rock. Which one has more value? Still water? Okay. Why? Exactly. Because right now you're thirsty. So let's just say you were in the middle of the desert, okay? And you're really thirsty, the scorching sun is out there, it's burning you, and you come across, say, a barrel of water, and then there's a barrel of oil, or maybe, like I say, a rock, there's gold. Someone's willing to offer you a pot of gold versus a pot of water. You're in the middle of the desert, you're a poor man, you know, the money could help, it would help you go a long way, but right now, you're dead thirsty. What is of more value? The pot of water. Why is it the one that has more value? Exactly, because value is the ability to fulfill a necessity. In that moment, your necessity is to quench your thirst. Isn't it? Let's say you somehow come out of the desert, now you're fine, you're well, you're safe, And then someone says, hey, I've got a pot of water and I've got a pot of gold. What would you like? Which one seems to be of more value now? The gold. Why is that? Once again, the necessity has changed, isn't it? Now, the gold would help. You know, you have debts to pay, you have a mortgage to clear, you know, you have all sorts of things you could do with it. You could keep it as an investment, right? You have all these ideas of what you could do with your gold. But a pot of water, you know, that can be found anywhere. You have plenty of water at home. You could go and grab it whenever you want it. Because right now, the necessity is not water. So when the necessity is whatever, that is what dictates value of something. Are you all in agreement with that? So value is determined by something's ability, its ability to fulfill a necessity. Okay, let's say again you're thirsty and I give you two glasses, both have liquids in them. One has pure water, the other has, let's say, water, but let's say it's a sugar drink. I'm not going to give any names because it's not nice for me to do it on a sermon. You can think of whatever drink you might like, right? Say a fizzy drink or something. So it's water, pure water, and a fizzy drink. Which one has more value? You're thirsty. Still what? Still water. Why is that? Because what you want is to quench the thirst. You know that the sugar in the drink is only going to make you thirstier. Yeah? So, once again, water wins. It's not because that value is intrinsic in the water. That's the point I want to try and get to. We tend to think that value is something intrinsic, meaning it's part and parcel of things. You tend to think that the sticker that goes on one of these things, like they say, you know, this is this much rupees, right, or whatever the price tag says, you tend to think that that price that is printed on it is an intrinsic attribute of this object. It is the impression that we tend to have in our minds. When I ask you the question, a diamond necklace, just imagine a diamond necklace. I mean, you can only imagine one, right? You've been telling your husband, you know, no chance. So just imagine that. Just imagine a diamond ring or whatever, right? Does a diamond ring have value? What is the value of a diamond ring? What's the value of a diamond ring? What is the value? What is the intrinsic value? How much are you willing to pay? I have a gold ring. How much are you willing to pay? And we're in the middle of the desert. And you're thirsty. Let's say you have $1 million with you. Okay? This diamond ring in the marketplace is worth 5 million. You have 1 million. Okay? You're really thirsty. You're in the middle of the desert. And I have a pot of water, which in the marketplace would probably fetch you, I mean, would be, what, say, 100 rupees. You have 1 million. How much are you prepared to pay for the diamond? Or for the ring? In the marketplace is 5 million. How much are you prepared to pay? I have a pot of water. I'm going to give it to the person who gives the most money. You have 1 million, the other person has 500,000, another has 100,000. Are you not prepared to give the full 1 million in exchange for the pot of water? You are, aren't you? So what is the value of a pot of water then? Is it 1 million? What is the value of a ring then? Is it 1 million? No. Value is not an intrinsic attribute. It is always determined. It's always determined by its ability to fulfill a necessity. Okay, now I'm going to repeat that one or two times because I want it to resonate in your minds for a second. I really want you to think about this and think about it seriously, ladies and gentlemen. If you can understand this concept, you will come to an aha moment where you will realize that there is nothing in this world that is actually of any value. This world is valueless. There's a better word for it, worthless. This world is worthless. Worth is always determined by how much you want something. It's determined by necessity. It is your necessity which determines the worth of something, the value of something. So what has to come first? Value? Excuse me. Or necessity? Which one has to come first? Necessity. Before you can answer the question of how much is something, how valuable something is, before you can answer this question, you will have to ask how necessary it is, won't you? See, a necessity is a deficiency. It's a deficiency. When you need something, you are deficient of it. Think of a few examples. When you're hungry, you are deficient of food. That's why you're hungry. That's where the necessity springs from. So then you go looking for food. And then you're prepared to pay, sometimes even over the odds, to get something that meets your need. Like at an auction, how is value determined? Exactly. You ask people how much you need this. What is your necessity? So one person says 100, the other says 200, the other says 250, the other says 500. Oh, 500, right. This from the other side of the room, from this from that room, and then somebody says 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000 going once, 1,000 going twice. And if you've ever been into an auction house, right, or at least you've had the opportunity to listen to what's going on there, you realize that the object itself has what value? Has no value at all. It has no value at all. Yes, they'll usually say, you know, this is the minimum price we're going to sell it at. We won't sell it at anything less than that. But that's because the current owner needs it by that much. That's why. That's why they set a minimum price. Anything less than this and we're not prepared to sell it. That means its current owner has a necessity for at least that much money. That's why they have set a minimum price. It's not because that is the value of the object. If that were the value of the object, how come the value can keep going up at the auction? So I have to ask you a question then, ladies and gentlemen. Take any object for that matter, this. What is its value? What is this pen's value? Forget about writing for a second. Forget about the need to write and use this as a marker pen. Okay? Forget about the need to write with this and now answer this question if you can. What is the value of this pen? What value does it have? Nothing. The concept of value itself, I'm talking about the actual concept of value, is actually based on necessity. If you take out necessity, the concept of value has no legs to stand on. It's a bit like this. This concept of time that we have, this concept of time exists because you feel you exist. When you feel you exist, you need some way of saying for how long. So when you have created a sense of existence in your own mind, through a process that we have talked about in the past and we'll talk about again in the future, this jati process, where you feel that you have once all of a sudden come into existence. When you feel a sense of existence, now you need a mechanism with which you can say for how long you have existed. It's like when you're waiting for the bus. You know you're waiting for the bus. You've been waiting for the bus. Then you say, I've been waiting for the bus for the last 10 minutes, for the last half an hour. How much longer must I wait? See, when you have this sense of existence, you have to put it on a timeline. So time is dependent on the concept of existence. In the same way, this concept of value is dependent on necessity. Now then, if there was no necessity, what would be the value of anything? Things would have no value at all. Things would have no value at all. See, gents in the house, you have a full head of hair, well, most of you do. And today, perhaps, you know, before you leave your house, you go in front of the mirror, maybe you even, you know, groom yourself, you brush your hair, yeah, you do it up and all sorts, apply some product or something, right? You want to look smart. Good. But what happens when you become a monk? Then this just becomes a pain in the, you know what. Because now, hair is of no value to me. But if you wanted to impress someone, maybe at an interview, you want to look smart and your hair is part of the package, right? Or you want to interest someone of the other sex, right? And perhaps they're interested in the way you look and your hair is part of the deal, right? Right? Are you ashamed when I say it like that? Don't be. Huh? So, you take a lady for that matter, for most women, their hair is a very important part of their appearance. Right, most women, like I can't say all women, because then you won't be happy with that. No? You know it's true, but you don't like me to say it out loud. All right. Oops. Right. So for most women, right, you do spend quite a lot of time in front of the mirror, right, doing your hair up and all that. You know, it's fine, right? We love you for all that. Right? It's fine. So, but let's say you decide one day to become a nun, and then every morning you have to shave your head. At that point, what is the value that you give to your hair? None. But while you're still a lay lady, a lay woman, right, and you have to have that appearance about you, so you have to impress, right, whoever, now your hair is of great value. So much so that you would even go to a contest and show off. Right? And what's it called? What Kalyani? Kesa Kalyani. Yes, Kesa Kalyani. And you know, some people, they even insure their hair. But did you know that? You can take out an insurance policy for your hair. Because that's an important part of their personality. So when the insurance underwriters, when the underwriter has to underwrite the value of your hair, right, they'll have to ask you a few questions. They'll have to ask you, why is your hair so important to you? And then you say, well, I'm an actress. Right? I'm a public figure. So my hair is of prime importance to me. And you know, the way I wear my hair and all that, it's all part to do with what opportunities I get in my work. So I need my hair to be in this way. Okay, well then based on that, and based on the risk there is to your hair, we're going to have to underwrite your hair, and this is the insurance plan. See, but what is the value of hair? It all depends on what your necessity is. If you need it to impress someone, then it's of great value. But once you decide to come into robes, for instance, and you choose to become a nun, now you have to keep shaving your hair every day. Now it becomes simply of zero value. In fact, if someone could cast a magic spell or something and stop your hair from growing at all, you know, I'd be quite happy to take that offer. It's such a pain, really. I have to, at least twice a week, I have to shave. Shave all this and shave my head. And I mean, I like a simple life. That's why I became a monk, partly at least. And this is a burden. This is just an extra piece of work I have to do. So if you had some way I could stop my hair growing on my head, I'd be up for that. But then there'll be some in the room who says, Swami Nas, you don't know what you're asking for. If there was a spell that could grow my hair, I would ask for that. Because actually when I was a layperson, I didn't have a lot of hair in the back of my head. So this, you know, it was not a big jump for me to go from that to this. But those ways, you know, there were times when I thought to myself, oh, how I wish I had more hair on my head. So those days I would have valued if someone had come and said, right, if you are prepared to give me this much, I'm prepared to give you some medicine or something that can help your hair grow really well, then I would probably have considered that. That's because I valued my hair. But now, no hair is better. So again, the question boils down to, what is the value of hair? This hair that you have on your head, as you go in front of the mirror and you look at it, just imagine, ladies and gentlemen, you know, let's say if you really value your hair, you treasure your hair, you love your hair. It sounds really weird, but you know what I mean, right? If you really love your hair, let's just say you wake up one morning, and you have long hair, let's assume, and you've been growing it for like the last, how long does it take to grow long hair? I don't know, you tell me. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, six? For the last 5 years, right? You wake up one morning and someone's played a practical joke on you. What? Yeah. Your little brother has chosen to play a practical joke on you. Right? So what they've done is they found a pair of scissors and they... What? Oh, see? I don't even have to say it. You wake up one morning and you realize that they've given you a... What do you call them? A bobby cut or something? Bob cut. Thank you. They've given you a bob cut. This is the hair that you loved and you treasured and you've been growing for the last 5 years. And you've been shampooing it, you've been conditioning it, you've been going to the saloon, and you've been doing all sorts, right? All because you treasure, you value your hair. And then someone's just cut your hair. How is that going to make you feel when you realize that they've just done that? It's going to give you a fit, isn't it? Why? Because you value it. Why do you value it? Because there's a necessity. It's just because there's a necessity. See, wherever there's value, necessity was the precursor to that. Necessity is always the precursor to value. Necessity is a deficiency. It's when you lack something. It's when there's a shortage of something. I have an even better word. It's when there is a vexation for something. That's not something to be proud of. This is not something to be proud of. But when you see things of value and you have things around you that have, you feel value, you feel proud about that. You do. Just think about, you know, walk into your homes for a second in your mind. Open the front door, you know, right through the porch and into the living room. Just look at how you laid out your living room for a second. That you have your carpets, if you have them, curtains, your sofas, right, your TV, and you know, all that stuff you have at home. Don't you feel house proud right now? Right? As a house owner. You feel house proud, and this, look, this is my nice, it's my crib, it's my place, right? My own thing. It's, you know, it's not the bee's knees, it's not a palace, but you know, I like it how it is. It's what I've been building up for the last so many years, and it has a lot of value to me. You say it has a lot of value to you, and you feel proud about it. Well, here's the deal. That value only comes out of necessity. Meaning there is something deficient in you. Do you feel proud about that? Let's say you're anemic. You're anemic, meaning you don't have enough. What's that stuff? Hemoglobin. Yes, you don't have enough hemoglobin in your blood. Who's proud about that? Your blood report comes and says you've not got enough hemoglobin in your blood. So you're anemic. Who's proud about that? No one's proud about that. Why? Because it's a deficiency. Whenever there's a deficiency, it's not something to be proud of. It's a problem that requires a solution. When people have a deficiency, they think that the solution to that problem is to go acquire the object that is deficient. And as they acquire it, they give it value. This value is only in the mind. All your necessities, besides the physical necessities, right? Besides things like hunger, thirst, and things like that. Okay? Where are these necessities? Let's take a TV, for instance. Let's take a TV. If you didn't watch TV, what would happen to you? Huh? Can't even imagine what would happen to me, Swami Nansi, if I didn't watch TV. Is that so? Nothing would happen to you, right? See, I don't watch TV. Nothing's happened to me. If you didn't listen to music, what would happen to you? Now, there may be some in the audience who really love their music. Okay? So I'm asking you a question. I mean, I used to love my music. I used to be a singer. Don't get me started on that. But I used to love my music. But is music something that you have to have in life? But it feels like that for some people. It feels like that for some people. Because they feel that music somehow has this ability to really fill their lives and give their lives meaning. Because they feel that has great value. Sentimental value is a really good example of this. You know, take an old photograph or some, say a family heirloom or something you might have. Something that your grandmother's grandmother used and then it got passed down through the generations and now it's your family's heirloom. How much value does that have, that object? It's just an old ring. 10 generations down, they used it. It was used as their engagement ring or their wedding ring or whatever, and it just got passed down and now it's yours. What is its intrinsic value? What is its intrinsic value? Absolutely none. Maybe if it's made of some kind of metal, you could take it to the smith and they would probably exchange it for something. But a tuppence worth, that's all. But to you, it has great value. Why? What's the precursor to value? Necessity. Because for you, it conjures up emotions. All these feelings. Nostalgia. Right? All these lovely feelings and emotions that helps you feel connected to your family, to your ancestors. All of that, it evokes those feelings in you when you take a glimpse of that ring. And therefore, it's valuable to you. It's only valuable to you. To you meaning, where is that value? In your mind. So is value a physical thing or a mental thing? What do you think? It's a mental thing. Ladies and gentlemen, value is a mental thing. If value is always determined by necessity, and you agree with me that value is a mental thing, where is that necessity? It's in the mind. Once again, to emphasize, I'm not talking about food, because food is a physical requirement, but it doesn't have to be certain kinds of food. That is not a requirement, right? So if you had to eat rice and curry, and then curry and rice the following day, and then rice and curry the next day. Like when you have to become an anagarika at our monastery. I know maybe that is one of the reasons why you haven't chosen that lifestyle yet. It's the same stuff every day. See, how come we are okay with that? Think about it. You know, it's not just the adults. Think about the children. I mean, their staple food is rice and curry. Of course, you know, for their nutrients, they get other stuff given to them to make sure that they're fit and healthy and they meet all the necessary health guidelines and all that. But, you know, generally speaking, it's the same diet. Like maybe two curries and rice and some melung or something. That's what we have. So, you know, not even our children ask us, can we have string hoppers tonight, please? Can we have a kottu tomorrow? Can we have pizza tonight, please? How about burgers? They don't ask for that. They don't ask for that because there's no necessity. Food, shelter, clothing, medicines, these things are things that the body needs. They are physical necessities. That's why even an Arahatan, one say, requires these. Even someone who has zero value in their mind to the material world will still need these four things, and they're called the four requisites because they're required. That's why they're called the requisites. Anything over and beyond that, particular types of food, particular kinds of clothes, particular types of shelter, they are not requisites. Because those things, they have value. And that value is attributed to them, but they are generated in the mind. That's why Rahatan Mahansa can live in a small kuti. But can you? How big is your house? Does it have to be that big? How many are you at home? And how many rooms do you have? Oh, you tell me this, well, Swami Nansi, it's the neighborhood. You have to be like that. Oh, yeah, I understand. That's not a necessity, though. I mean, that's not a physical necessity. You know, at the monastery, we have a kuti about the size of maybe half the size of this stage, or maybe three quarters of it. And three or four Swami Nuhansas live in that kuti. And that's their residence. So there are beds for them and they stay there. That is their residence. There's a common washroom that everyone uses. See, that is a lifestyle that one can quite easily adapt to if they don't have these mental necessities. Because at the monastery, what we do is we provide for the physical necessities. And there's never any shortage of that. If you're hungry, we feed you. Until you're full, we feed you. Not to worry about that. If you're unwell, we will nurse you. Until you're well, we will nurse you. There's no worry about that. And our devotees are just always at the beck and call. If ever there's a Swami Nuhansa who is unwell, there are many of our devotees who said, just give me a call. That's all I need to hear. I will make sure that the Swami Nuhansa is nursed back to health and get all the medicines and the best specialist care necessary. That's how devoted our devotees are. I'm talking about you, Lord. Then we are given shelter. So where it is required for someone to have a peaceful night's sleep, right, that is provided at the monastery. So food, shelter, clothes, these are our clothes. We are robes. How many sets of robes does a monk need? Two. Because while this is on me, the other needs to be washed on the clothesline. And it's drying right now. So I just keep jumping from one robe to the other. That's what I do. So when I get back tonight, this afternoon, back to the monastery, I will put on the other robe and wash this robe. So it'll be ready again when I need it next. That is a necessity, a physical necessity. But when I was a lay person, oh, things were different. I had a wardrobe full of clothes in there. I had quite a few pairs of shoes. There was the work shoes, There were the party shoes. There were the going out shoes, the casual pair to go with friends. And then there was another pair to go out with, like, you know, the special friends. I don't mean like in that way. I didn't have any special friends like that. I mean, you know, friends like who would expect you to, I don't know, say the elite friends, let's just say. That kind of type. Variety was a necessity. Because there was a certain lifestyle that I wanted to have. And that was part of a mental necessity. It was not a physical necessity. And so those were things that I had as my possessions, and I gave them value. So much so that when I went shopping, I was prepared to part with my hard-earned money. Because I thought they had value. That's why I ask you the question, how valuable is a diamond necklace? Can you eat it? Does it sate your hunger? Does it quench your thirst? Can you use it as a roof above your head? Can you wear it around you and cover your nakedness? Can you do that? Your nudity? You can't do that. When you're unwell, when you're sick, can you make use of it to heal yourself? You can't. So then what is the value of a diamond necklace? But if I asked you, you'd say, it's worth so many millions. Where is that value? Did you know that gold is rarer than diamonds? Did you know that? Gold is rarer than diamonds. So how come diamonds are more expensive than gold? It's artificial. It's an artificially inflated value. That's how they do commerce. That's how they do business in this world. Because value is not intrinsic, they can do whatever the heck they want with it. See, if value was actually an attribute of an object, like its weight, for instance, it's not an object, it's not a subjective thing. The weight of an object is an objective thing. Its dimensions, they're not subjective, they're objective. The length, width, breadth of something, it doesn't change depending on who measures it. But what about value? It changes. In your hands, it'll be worth one thing, madam. In your hands, it'll be worth another. Isn't that why there's this saying, one man's treasure is another man's trash, or the other way around, one man's trash is another man's treasure? What is that differentiator? What makes one treasure, what makes the other trash? It's value, isn't it? But value based on necessity. The point I'm trying to get across to you here, ladies and gentlemen, is can you try from here on, right? Whenever you feel that something is of value. Today I'm talking about material, physical things. Tomorrow I'll talk to you about other things. Even the people in your lives. But let's not go there just yet. Otherwise you will not come back here for next Sunday. You know, because these are the things that you feel is what samsara has offered you. And you are not prepared to give them up. That's why when I ask you to come with me to the monastery, you're not prepared to go with me. Because you feel that there are things of value. You know, maybe there's a young man here, right, who's looking forward to get married to someone. Maybe there's a young lady here who's looking forward to get married to someone. And they're not prepared to come and experience this holy, noble life because they feel that there's an individual who is of great value. And they can't let go of them. It's value that stops you from letting go of anything. Do you remember the very first talk that we did? Of course not. That was a long time ago. But the very first talk that we did in the other series, Buddha's Guide to Happiness, he was talking about this. Buddhism is not about letting go. Actually, it was the second talk. The first one was why Buddhism? The second one was about it's not about letting go. Buddhism is not about letting go. Buddhism is about realizing that there is nothing of value to let go. The reason you struggle to let go is because you think it has value in it. So you are always attached to it. I can't let go. This is valuable. This is so valuable. How can I let go? I have to protect it. This means a lot to me. How can I let go? It's so valuable to me. You think that value is in this object. That's how people can take you for a fool. That's why you're prepared to part with your cash. Because all a salesman has to do is to make you believe that there's value in something that he has. Because you're already prepared to believe that value is a characteristic of objects. You believe that value is an attribute of objects. All he or she has to do is, hey, I've got another object. It has value. Because you already accept the fact that things have values, right? Or things have value. And then, now you're prepared to part with your cash to acquire that object. But what I'm asking you to do here is, excuse me, look at value from a different lens. This value is not in the object. It's in your mind. So if value is in your mind, there's nothing to let go. You just need to realize that there is no value here. All there is a necessity. And for as long as that necessity exists, you will believe that things in the world have value. Because you're always looking for something or the other that can fulfill that void, that inadequacy, that deficiency, that necessity. So what if, ladies and gentlemen, I can give you the Dhamma, a teaching, a philosophy that helps you understand. Where's that Pengo? What if I can give you the Dhamma that can once and for all eradicate necessity? This necessity is an inadequacy in your mind. The reason that you are dependent on the people around you, the reason that you can't leave behind the people around you, because you know one way or the other you're going to have to leave them, right? That's why you're afraid of dying. You're afraid of death because you have a necessity. That's why. You have an inadequacy. You need someone there to be with you to fulfill that necessity. That's why being alive is valuable, because being alive means you can be with people who feel that necessity. That's why you're afraid of dying. But you know that death is just around the corner. That corner might be a few hundred yards, 1,000 yards, maybe several thousand yards away, but still it's only around the corner. You know, next time, this year, this time next year, I don't think that all of you will be still coming to the sermon. Not unless I say Samantha Chakravaris. And then make an invitation to the gods and the departed ones. Are you so sure that this time next year you'll all be coming to the sermon? What if you come but I'm not here? That's also quite possible. So we know that death is an inevitable reality that's going to come to us, but we don't prepare ourselves, because for as long as this necessity exists, ladies and gentlemen, in your minds, you dread death. That's why you're so scared of death. Because living is an opportunity for you to make use of things that are available in the outside world to keep filling this necessity. Every time you open your eyes, you give value to sight. That's why you treasure your eyesight so much. That's why your eyesight is so valuable to you. Because there's a necessity here to see. Why is a prison a prison? Isn't locking someone in a dark room the punishment? Why? Exactly. Because they have a necessity to see. How about if you locked a Rahatan Mahansi in a dark room? Do you think that would be a punishment to him? No. Because someone who doesn't want to see, you cannot punish them by taking away their faculty of sight. That's why the prison system works in that way as a punishment. The prison system works as a punishment mechanism because you've put people there, people who don't want to be there. People who want to be on the other side of the wall, you put onto this side of the wall, and now that becomes a prison. Because they have a necessity to leave. They want to go out and see the things that you see, do the things that you do, experience the world as you do. That's why it's punishment to them. Did I tell you once we were allowed to go and preach to the prisons? Yeah, so many years ago, not many years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, we got an invitation, we went to preach to the prisons. And so I asked those inmates, is this a punishment to you? And they said, yes, Swami, this is a punishment to us. Well, I said, well, I'm going to talk to you, let me teach you how not to make this a punishment. I said, this is only a punishment to you because you want to be outside, because you want to see what's going on outside. Well, let me explain to you that they are of no value. Let me make rahat advances out of you. And then you'll be fine. This will no longer be a punishment. So the next day they said, don't come again for the sermons. That's how, you know, we take the message of freedom to people. So don't put me in front of a prisoner and expect to continue to punish him by keeping him an inmate in a prison. Because I'm going to talk to him. If you let me talk to him, I'm going to talk to him. And I'm going to explain to him that what he thinks is of value outside those four walls is actually of no value at all. It is only value that is given because of a necessity in his own mind. And then I will work with him to eradicate that necessity. Once you break that, he no longer needs to leave the four walls. He'll just be saying, ah, wonderful, I get free meals, free clothes. Right? When I'm ill, I get free treatment. Right? And I have a free roof above my head. I don't even pay taxes. That's paradise. What's so different about the life of a prison inmate and a monk? There's only one difference. Take me, for instance. I have to wear what you give. See, these robes, you offered them. What about the prison inmates? What do they get to wear? What the guards give them, right? I have to eat what you feed me. I can't go shopping and do my own cooking, right? So I have to eat what you offer. What about the inmates? They also have to eat what they are fed. I have to live in whatever you build for me. Right? If you make a kuti this small, then I have to keep standing there. I can't even sit down. That's the kuti. Right? So what about the inmates then? They also have to live in whatever is built for them. What about when I'm unwell? When I'm indisposed, right? Then I have to survive on whatever treatment you can afford. If you can't afford it, then that's it. I can't afford it either. Let's say I need a heart transplant. My heart is failing. Right? Then all I can do is see if there's a devotee or a group of people who might be able to find a donor and do a heart transplant for me. And if you can't afford it, then that's it. My days are numbered. What can I do? What about the prison inmate? It's the same thing, right? So the same deal. But why is it that for him it's a punishment and for me it's not? Huh? No necessity. So can't you make a prison a temple and a temple a prison? What changed? Necessity. All value, ladies and gentlemen, is based on the foundation of necessity. Necessity is an inadequacy. It's when the mind feels and thinks that it needs something. That's what a necessity is. I'll quickly recall a sermon that we did a couple of weeks ago. What is consciousness? We talk about what consciousness is. Consciousness is simply a chitta that arises in this physical form of yours. Its objective is merely to perceive an object. That's it. Not to need an object. When you present an object in front of your eye, a chitta is born, a consciousness is born, and all that consciousness is supposed to do is to perceive that object. As soon as it has perceived it, its job is done, and it passes away. However, if that process happens on a bed of ignorance, what is that ignorance? Here's a penny dropping moment. Ignorance that they have intrinsic value. That is the ignorance. If a chitta, a consciousness, a mind is born on a bed of ignorance, that ignorance itself being that the object that it is, that it was born to perceive, has intrinsic value. What value? Intrinsic value, meaning value in the object itself. Now, that chitta wishes to see. It wishes to see. It has a desire to see. Then it has to be there to do something more than simply perceive, because it wants to perceive. It now has to perceive. It desires to perceive. It longs to perceive. That is vexation. Which is why I'm trying to explain to you now then that value is not intrinsic in an object. If you can understand that, then the bed on which your chittas arise and pass away will come to the realization that those objects are not intrinsically valuable at all. They have no intrinsic value whatsoever, meaning when the object is presented to you, your chitta will simply arise and pass away, having merely perceived the object. But until you comprehend that, perhaps you now understand it, you've maybe seen this, the tip of the iceberg, you now scratch the surface. Once you really comprehend that, your chittas will simply arise and pass away, having perceived the objects that are around you, not wanting to see, not wanting to hear, not wanting to smell, not wanting to taste, not wanting to touch, not wanting to even think. You will think, but you don't want to think. You can see, but you don't necessarily want to see. You understand the difference, right? Seeing and wanting to see. Yeah, you see because you can see. You want to see, now you have to see. That's the vexation inside. All of that is because you think that there's an intrinsic value in sights. That's why prison is a prison. Because people believe, all those inmates believe that these objects, these sight objects, they have intrinsic value, ladies and gentlemen. What a pity. So actually, prison is not where they are. Where is the prison? It's in their minds. That's just another house. That's just another home for them. So then you can't accuse the guards, or the system, or the authorities of imprisoning those inmates, because they have done nothing of that sort. They've done nothing of that sort. If that were true, then I'm also in a prison. So who prisons oneself? It's themselves, yes. You create your own prison. Merely by giving value to sights, sounds, smell, taste, touch, and thoughts. Because once you need them, there's a necessity, and then you give value to those things. And once you have given those that value, you know, this becomes a perpetually, this is what happens. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you think there's value, there's a necessity. When there's a necessity, you give value. And when there's value, there's again necessity. And when there's necessity, you give value. Let me know when I can stop. When there's value. You understand? See? So where do you break this loop? All of this is running on ignorance. It's all running on ignorance. to break this, ladies and gentlemen, you need to understand that there is nothing of value. It's a realization, not a letting go. It's not to let go. Let it be. Nothing to let go. Actually, if there's anything you want to let go, the only letting go you need to do is of ignorance. Let go of your ignorance. Not the objects, not the people, not your possessions. Just let go of that ignorance. But that's not a physical thing to do. All you have to do is listen to the Dhamma, reflect on the Dhamma, and contemplate the Dhamma, and eventually it will become your understanding and your comprehension. That is what the Noble Eightfold Path does. It brings you to a realization that there are things that nothing is of value. And once that happens, necessity? No more necessity. Because there's no more necessity, there's no more value. And you break the cycle. This is the cycle of samsara. This is samsara. That's why I said you can't come out of samsara because you want these things. Because you value them. Why do you value them? Because you have a necessity for them. Why do you have a necessity for them? Because you value them. Why do you value them? Because you have a necessity for them. See, it's a wonderful, vicious cycle. So once it starts, you can just keep on going. You don't need anyone's help for that after you started. Now you are on automatic. You run automatically now. You don't need anyone's help. Only to get you started, you needed something. Now this just keeps on running perpetually. Until a Kalyanamitra comes along. A Buddha or a descendant of the Buddha. And explains to you, there is no intrinsic value in any of these things. And then that breaks the cycle. If it breaks here, it breaks here. That's it. No more necessity, no more value, and no more samsara. That's what it is. Did that make sense? Sure? Good. Right. Now, over the course of the next week, I would like you to actually do a bit of a practical. Okay, just to give this a little bit more time to settle in your mind. When you have a spare moment in your leisure time, right? As you're having your afternoon tea or something, whatever. Think about the things you have at home that you feel are of value to you. You can start with something material. Don't start with your wife. We'll come to that later. Okay. Start. I know, that's where you're so keen to start, right? Don't start there. Start with something small, something simple, something material, right? Even if you have like something of sentimental value, these are very easy for you to understand. Because you know this is only of value to me. No one else values this stuff. This junk to someone else. Yeah? So those things are easy targets. But have a few things that you can think of. Just relax. Nothing too stressful. Have a few things that you have at home and ask yourself, what did I pay for that? And something will come to mind. What did I pay for that? Then ask yourself, when I paid for that, did I not think that that value is actually in the object? And the answer would be, yes, I thought that, because as we say, it's worth it. You say that, don't you? It's not worth that much, you say. Huh? That much meaning you give it a number. How can it not be worth that much as a number? This is what it should be based on. Isn't it? You should be able to say it's not worth that much necessity. It's not worth that much money. That's the thing. Because you have money between any two objects, you know, you've completely lost sight of what's actually going on here. The thing is this, you need money as well, and you need the object as well. When you say that it's not worth that much money, what you're really saying is, I need the money more than I need that. That's what you're really saying. That's when you say it's not worth that much money. You need the money more, that amount of money, you need the money more than you need that object. Because there are other things you're willing to part with that amount of money in exchange for that object. Do you agree with what I'm saying? You are willing to pay X to buy a loaf of bread, but you might not be willing to pay that to buy, put loaf of bread to aside, maybe you're willing to pay so much to buy a house, but you're not willing to pay that to buy a loaf of bread. Because the money is more valuable to you than the bread. That's how you make these measurements in your mind. That's how you value things in your mind. When money comes in as the external, what do you call it, the medium, let's just say. But the problem is now that money has come into this equation, you feel that when you value things, it's all based on a monetary value. But it's not so. It's actually based on a necessity. So the task I have for you is, throughout the course of the next week, if you have a spare moment, have a think of some things that you have at home, and then ask yourself, what value did I pay for that? And is it actually worth the money, or was there a necessity for that? So much so, ladies and gentlemen, you will realize that there are some things that today you would not pay that much. I can see people nodding frantically. Yes, Swami, no, sir. Only if someone would come and buy it off of me. I'm sure there are plenty of things at home that if you went shopping today, you wouldn't buy that. You wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. You wouldn't touch it, let alone buy it. But then back then, there was a necessity that was created in your mind because the advertisers did a fantastic job. The salesman did a great job. And they created a necessity in your mind. That necessity was gone 2 days later. Now you're left with the thing you purchased. And it says, no returns, no refunds. Now what do you do? See, this is how, if you don't understand the dynamics here, ladies and gentlemen, people put you into those traps. You become a victim then of a dog-eat-dog world. I can't change the world because it is what it is. But I can help you look at the world from a fresh perspective so that you don't become a victim of people's, I don't know, their inadequacies. People out there, they're also in the same trap. That's the thing. They're also in the same trap. They need what you have. Why? Because they have a necessity. You have money in the bank and they have some goods in the store. What is their necessity? They need your money. So what do they have to do now? You're not just going to give them your money for nothing. They have to create in your mind a necessity for the goods that they have. Don't they? So that's what they do. That's what marketing does. That's what advertising does. That's what the billboards do. That's what the campaigns do. Keep on creating a necessity in your minds. If you fall for that, now you start giving those things value. And then you ask yourself, what's more valuable to me, that or the money in my hand? At that point, when you realize that, or when you think that it is of more value than the money in your bank or the money in your hand, now you're willing to exchange. That's how business works. It's all down to a mental inadequacy that the whole commercial world can actually exist in the way it does. But no one talks about this stuff, partly because no one knows what's really going on. And the other part is, even if they did, they wouldn't want to tell you about this stuff because that's what fills their coffers. If you don't understand this stuff, ladies and gentlemen, you're just lab rats. Sorry to say. If you don't make sense of all this stuff, you are just lab rats to the world out there. They will just squeeze every penny out of you. And please don't hate them for that. Don't resent them for that. Don't have spite in your hearts because of that. They're also in the same trap. Only one who has come out of this trap, or at least who has seen the plight of this trap, will help you to walk out of that themselves. One who is already in it doesn't know any better. That's why the salesman will just keep on coming and knocking on your door relentlessly. Sometimes you wonder, you know, what a pain in the backside these people are. Why can't they just go away without bothering me? Every Sunday they come and bother me. What can they do? They need what you have. So they will somehow find a way to make you want what? What make you want what? They have. And for that they have to talk to you. They have to come dressed very, you know, smart and dapper. Suited and booted, they'll come up to you. And they'll give you a good talk. They've trained themselves for that. They're not evil or vile or vicious because of the fact that they do that. It's just what they have to do because they want what you have. You give it to them without argument and they'll walk away. If you're prepared to give what they want that you have, right, they will stop bugging you. What do you have that they want? Money. So you give them your money, just give them a blank check, they won't come back again. I promise you. I mean, they're not coming to you to get your, take your hand in marriage. They just want your money. They're not coming to you because they like to have a talk with you or to spend their Sunday afternoon with you. No. They want to go back to their families just as much as you do. But you have something that they want. So they have to get it somehow. And the only way you're prepared to let go of what you have is if you get something that you want. So what are they going to have to do now? They have to convince you that what they have is what you want. And how are they going to convince you of that? By talking to you. So they'll keep on bugging you. You can't hate them for that. It's what they have to do. It's how the world works. But what I'm saying is, I can't stop any of that. But if you understand that this is what's going on, you won't fall victim to that. I'm not the world's savior. I'm only here to save you. If you want to be saved, come here. I can't go saving the world. If you want to be saved, come here. Then I'll save you. So, this is your homework then. Take a spare moment. Look at a few things that you have at home. If you want to, jot it down if you like. And ask yourself, how much did I pay for that? You can put down the price you paid for it. Then ask yourself, is it actually worth that price? Or what was the reason I was willing to part with this amount of money to buy that? Was it the price that I thought was worth it? Or was it the necessity that I had at that time? Does the necessity, is this necessity still there? Isn't that why, if today I was asked to buy that, I would not be prepared to pay that money? All of this is simply to help you better understand that value is not an intrinsic attribute of an object. It's all mind-driven. Once you realize that, then you'll be convinced that the only thing we have to do now is break this necessity and value loop. But for that, you have to first acknowledge that value is not in objects. It's only in your own mind. Shall we leave it at that? Okay. Good, you've been a great audience. Please take some time to actually do what I've asked you to do at home, because that will help to better cement this idea and help you better understand it. Right, let's do the merit transfer then and bring today's sermon to a close. First and foremost, let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired. By making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, listening to the Dhamma and creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path, let us transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine, including the Mahanayakas and the Anunayaka theatres of all the chapters. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks and nuns resident, all the monks resident at the monastery, and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the friends of our monastery, the devotees, who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees and our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who've made an extra effort on our behalf, who's left no stone unturned to help make our lives comfortable. Let us take a moment to transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. May by the power of these merits they also be freed from any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our names, our forefathers, our ancestors, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives on our behalf. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, including those who might have lost their lives in ongoing wars and so on, reminding us that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends to us. With an abundance of loving kindness and compassion towards all of them, let us transfer all these merits to all of them. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds or thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Piranin Mahanse in this life itself and in the era of this Buddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen idetnva desha ginnen idetnva moha ginnen idetnva nibbana parama sukhayen Sukhita taravetna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetna Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetna Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva
Mohagini Nireva Nivansapa Labeva Nivansapa Labeva Nivansapa Labeva.
තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතිතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.